From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week was the week the country was supposed to switch altogether and forever from analog TV broadcast to digital. But even though Congress and the FCC began talking about a transition in 1996, and the legislation that outlined the changeover was signed 3 years ago, we, the people, weren't ready. So Congress postponed the deadline from this Tuesday to June 12th. Still, more than 400 broadcasters in smaller markets did opt to turn off their analog signals and switch to digital broadcast, and they launched furious public education campaigns to pave the way. Too little, too late. Many viewers woke up this week to blank televisions. Washington Post reporter Kim Hart has been covering the transition. Kim, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, could you tell me again why we're doing this?
Sure. Well, this is all part of a plan that was designed to reclaim the spectrum that the over-the-air broadcasters and network broadcasters have been using for over half a century. The reason they wanted to do that is because they wanted to give them back to public safety organizations so that they could use them for their first responders' communication networks, as well as make some money for the government and sell them at an auction to wireless companies like Verizon and AT&T.
Now, what we're talking about, obviously, is switching from over-the-air broadcast, once accessible to anyone who has a bent coat hanger and a TV, to digital reception, which most people get through cable or satellite receivers. How many people still rely on the rabbit ears?
Well, anywhere between about 10 million and 20 million households, especially in rural areas. Internet doesn't reach all the way out to where they live, and in some markets, this is their main gateway to information, local news, and emergency notifications.
You write that the digital transition bill was born amid sniping between Republicans and Democrats, which time and again complicated its implementation.
They delegated different parts of the program to help consumers get prepared to different agencies. The Federal Communications Commission was in charge of getting all the technical aspects ready. And the National Telecommunications and Information Administration, they were charged with running the Converter Box coupon program, which basically gave consumers $40 coupons to help offset the cost of a converter box. The main consternation was over how much money was really going to be available for consumers to buy converter boxes. Republicans wanted it to be specifically for low-income viewers, and Democrats wanted it to be open to everyone. They compromised on letting it be open to everyone who wanted a converter box, but they didn't raise the amount of funding going to that program. So there ended up being a shortfall. That's when the real concern began about, okay, maybe the country really isn't ready to make this switch just yet.
So are they going to put more money into it?
Yes. The stimulus package does contain several hundred million dollars that will be put in part towards the converter box coupon program. And the NTIA has said that once they get that money, they'll be able to clear the backlog of coupon requests in a matter of weeks.
So the government decided to respond to this mess by doing the transition in a kind of piecemeal fashion. Some stations will use the extended June deadline. Some turned off their analog earlier this week. Can you tell us what the reaction to the process has been?
It's been mixed. The day of the switch on the 17th itself, the FCC received nearly 30,000 calls. The people who are most affected have been elderly viewers who haven't touched their TV setup in years, non-English speakers. You know, it's confusing to people who speak English, and let alone trying to translate it and figure out what that means for their TV set, as well as low income. You know, they're the ones who can't afford to say, oh, well, maybe I'll just go ahead and switch to cable. And with the economy being in the shape that it is, a lot of people have been considering dropping their cable and satellite service altogether. So the number of people affected has actually increased.
Kim Hart is staff writer for The Washington Post. Kim, thanks very much.
Thank you.
To ensure you'll still receive your analog signal during this temporary delay, remove your digital set-top converter by following, in reverse, the 11 steps you use to install it.
Oh, boy.
And reattach the antenna that came with your analog television.
But the garbage man took it away.
Again, our bad. Simply locate the dump where your garbage is delivered and retrieve your antenna.
Is this it?
We appreciate your patience in this exciting transition to 100% digital broadcasting.
This is a lot of effort for Wheel of Fortune.
That came from the website Funny or Die. One way to sidestep the digital broadcast conversion headache is having or getting cable. Cable subscribers are not affected by the switcheroo. And if you do get cable, there's a good chance you'll be sending your monthly check to Comcast. It's the cable monopoly in 40 of the top 50 markets. It's also the third largest phone company in the U.S., and it's the largest provider of broadband internet to homes. With great power comes great visibility, and Comcast is excruciatingly visible. In late 2007, Comcast was caught blocking its own customers from file sharing. Specifically, it was stopping people from uploading content, whether a song, a movie, or even text, onto peer-to-peer networks using applications like BitTorrent. This is just one of many things that's made Comcast so unpopular. In fact, in a couple of recent brand reputation and customer satisfaction surveys, Comcast's rep hovered just above such corporate boogeymen as the war profiteering Halliburton and subprime mortgage lending Countrywide. A few years back, our own Bob Garfield created an online clearinghouse for customer complaints that he no longer runs, which is why he's not doing this interview. In this month's Wired magazine, senior writer Daniel Roth fleshes out the Comcast uploading scandal, which began with a man named Rob Topolsky.
Rob Topolsky was an Intel engineer who was having a medical issue. He couldn't stay awake. He wasn't sure why. He was on medical disability. And he was at home, decided to play with some new technology. And one of the things he was really interested in learning about was file sharing. He's very into barbershop harmony. He wanted to share some of his songs from the Civil War era. And no one was biting on any of his music he was trying to upload. He figured, you know, this wasn't the most popular music, but still someone should want it.
Not a single person seemed to.
Not one person. No one in the entire world who uses file sharing. So he started investigating. He's a software engineer, knows how to do this, and discovered after months and months, when he was awake and able to actually sit at his computer, that there was something wrong with his local internet service provider who happened to be Comcast.
Describe how they were blocking the file sharing.
If you think about this as a phone call, the way it would work is if you were talking to a friend and suddenly your friend said, "I have to go, I'm hanging up right now." And your friend at the same time heard you say, "I'm hanging up, I have to go right now." But neither of you had ever said anything. It is purely a disguise. It's the phone company getting on there and pretending to be you. That's what Comcast was doing. They were sending packets along that pretended to be the other computer saying, "Please stop giving me this file." And the other computer would say, "Please stop taking my files." That lack of transparency cost them a lot in terms of their reputation, and it caused them a lot of trouble.
Let's talk about Comcast's side here for a second. They say, and it's true, that when people upload or download huge files, it slows the traffic on the internet for everybody, and that they were just managing that, making it more fair. And Brian Roberts, the head of Comcast, didn't understand why people were so angry at him.
Yeah. As he explained to me, he said, on Mother's Day, AT&T has to manage its phone network because there are so many calls going on. It overloads the system. Every network manages itself. He just saw himself managing his network. I think one of the problems that Comcast got into, and this speaks to a lot about where Comcast is today, is they didn't realize the power of a small group of people on the internet to cause an international incident. If you live in Louisville, Kentucky, and you don't like your cable provider, your neighbors know that you're complaining. On the internet, everyone in the world knew that there was this problem with file sharing, and people in Sweden and in Japan were upset with Comcast for doing it. Comcast couldn't believe the uproar and the amount of anger that was being leveled against them. So they conducted some focus groups around the country, and they found, A, that their users barely had any idea what file sharing was. This was a small group of people. Not everyone uses file sharing. And once they had it explained to them exactly what was going on and how file sharing can use up bandwidth for everyone, the focus groups tend to be on Comcast's side.
On the other hand, the network neutrality types, the people who believe that the internet needs to be a level playing field for all of its users, were concerned that there was active discrimination going on against those who used BitTorrent and other peer-to-peer file sharing services. Yes, it's true. They slow the traffic for everybody. On the other hand, if you start discriminating against them, where does it end?
Exactly. This is very much a slippery slope argument. And the people who are defending the internet and users' rights have used this as a way to say, if we let Comcast do this, what's next? Will they block certain websites? Will they give preference to their own video over the internet rather than YouTube video over the internet? You know, these are all things that could come if we allow Comcast to slow down file sharing.
So anyway, the clamor over this whole deal got so loud that the FCC issued a 67-page report.
Yeah, the FCC basically said Comcast was lying to us. They were lying to users. They were discriminating against traffic. And possibly they were doing this because they wanted to protect their own video properties, which is exactly what some of the people who really saw Comcast as being an evil company were saying. It was surprising to see this in an FCC report. And they said, you got to stop.
And what did Brian Roberts of Comcast say?
Brian took two paths at the same time. Number one, he said he was going to stop. And he started to embrace openness a little bit. And they put together a proposal explaining exactly how they managed their network, what kind of technology they were using. And they said, from now on, we're going to put a cap in place. You cannot download over 250 gigabytes a month of data over our network. And 250 gigabytes is a lot of data.
What does that mean in user terms?
Well, if you wanted to download 125 movies in standard definition, you could. If you were really into YouTube, you could watch 1,750 hours of YouTube a month and not hit that cap.
Okay.
So it's a very generous cap.
You say in your piece that, quote, in the end, the geeks won, but they may have unwittingly hurt their own cause.
This cap is an interesting thing. The cap basically stops discrimination. You can download data any way you want and get to the 250 gigabyte a month cap. But once you have the biggest player in the country saying a cap is okay, it's much easier for every other cable company and DSL provider to also say a cap is fine. And they're not going to go to 250. It's going to be much, much lower, or it's going to be tiered. You're going to pay a certain amount for a certain amount of bandwidth, and you're going to have to be thinking about what you're downloading and what you're watching. And that could have a really chilling effect on innovation on the net.
What do you think that the election of Barack Obama will mean for Comcast? He's already said that he's going to make some changes at the FCC. Does the company have an even stronger adversary now?
I think so. I mean, the people who have been advising Obama on what to do with the FCC are very, very big network neutrality proponents. And they are, at least according to their blogs and what they've written in the past, very anti-Comcast actions. Comcast is not going to go through a honeymoon period here with the Obama administration.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Daniel Roth is a senior writer for Wired Magazine.
This week, President Obama signed the $787 billion stimulus package into law. The bill received no Republican votes in the House and only three in the Senate. And for a president who said he wanted more bipartisanship in Washington, not a great start.
Wow, a funny thing happened on the way to the honeymoon. Republicans scowl and growl and ask, where's the bipartisanship,
this is
Mr. President?
As harshly partisan as anything I saw. Well, my gosh, it's the same with
President
George
Obama
Bush.
I'm going to realize that this really lofty goal of bipartisanship isn't necessarily achievable.
219 possible Republican votes. Obama got three. How could he possibly say this bipartisanship?
But what does the word bipartisan really mean? James Marone is the chair of the Political Science Department at Brown University. He joins us. Jim, welcome to the show.
Bob, hi. I'm glad to be on.
Is it your sense that in their take on what constitutes bipartisanship, the media was looking for some sort of ebony and ivory hand-in-hand ideal of collegiality on Capitol Hill?
The great kumbaya moment. Part of this is just that great old American myth that once upon a time, we lived in a land where every side got together, particularly in hard times, and we've lapsed from that time. And that really is a myth. Go back to the New Deal, the worst economic crisis in this one, obviously. And for a time, the Republicans really did pitch in and help Franklin Roosevelt out. Flash forward just 2 years, we're still in the Great Depression, and Social Security comes before Congress. One lone Republican from New Jersey voted for Social Security, everybody else against it. So we shouldn't get into this idea that there was once a rosy past where we all got along during hard times, because American history just doesn't bear that out.
Well, let's go a little farther back to the late 19th century. Tell me about the Mugwumps.
The Mugwumps were a group of gentlemen called mugwumps because they straddle the political fence. Their mugs faced one way and their wumps faced another. The mugwumps believed that there was way too much politics in politics. The mugwumps used to love to say, there's no Republican or Democratic way to pave a street. The old party stalwarts treated the mugwumps with great contempt. The pejorative that struck was goo-goo, short for goody-goody. And it stuck because this goo-goo illusion is the illusion that all politics can be boiled down to efficient public service. It's not about efficiency. It's about choosing between clashing values. Do you want more government? Do you want less? Politics is how we sort out, how we fight, how we battle, how we choose between clashing views of the world.
So are the media naive in speaking about this platonic ideal of bipartisanship as if it were something that's actually achievable?
There's never been an era that you can point to and say, ah, a bipartisan era. But there have been great bipartisan moments. One example that comes to mind is the civil rights legislation of 1964 and 1965. There's a case where the Democrats could not pass that legislation, divided by Southern Democrats and Northern, 67-day filibuster. And the day was saved by a small group of Republicans, led by Everett Dirksen of Illinois, who came to the rescue and really quite bravely broke the filibuster and helped pass the civil rights legislation. A great bipartisan moment, though Lyndon Johnson says as he signs it, there goes the South for the Democrats. And sure enough, there it went. The real problem, Bob, I think, of what's been going on in the media over the Obama effort at bipartisanship is the media has really focused on things they can count. So count the number of Republican votes, zero. That's a failure. It's not bipartisan. There's another thing you can count, the poll numbers. Republicans looking bad, Obama looking good. So his effort at bipartisanship has been a success from that perspective. It's much harder to get a handle around the tone of the conversation in Washington. And in that sense, Obama's been trying to do something new that the media has completely let slide under their radar screen. That has changed the tone, if not necessarily the outcomes of the conversation.
Jim, thank you very much.
It was a lot of fun.
James Marone is the chair of the Department of Political Science at Brown University and author of the upcoming book, The Heart of Power, Health and Politics in the Oval Office. And now we bring you another segment in our ongoing series on present and future business models for monetizing the newspaper industry.
Present and future business models for monetizing the newspaper industry.
There's no shortage of proposals. Some think newspapers should make online readers pay a monthly or yearly subscription fee. Others think online newspapers could charge a small 1 or 2 cent fee called a micropayment for every article the reader opens. Still others think newspapers should be owned by nonprofit foundations endowed by rich people as a matter of noblesse oblige. Then there's John Stewart's scheme.
You know how when you're reading the newspapers and the newsprint comes off in your hands?
Yeah.
What if we made that a highly addictive narcotic?
Wow, what an idea.
So that if you read it, you'd be like, I gotta get my hands on another newspaper, man.
Cynthia Topaldos, founder and CEO of Kachingle.com, has yet a different idea. Create a way that users can voluntarily contribute to their favorite online content without really thinking about it.
Let's say I go to a blog and I go, oh my God, this is great. I just love it. All I do is click on the Kachingle medallion, which that blog has installed, and I say, this is a blog I love. And then every time I come back to that blog, Kachingle keeps track of that. And at the end of the month, it takes my voluntary contribution and distributes it fairly across any kind of content or even service that I visited that month.
So I decide I want to pay $5 a month for my online media consumption, and Kachingle allocates it based on what medallions I've clicked on and then what percentage of my online time has been devoted to each of those medallions.
Exactly. So you can visit a blog that has the Kachingle medallion and read it as much as you want, but if it's not something you want to support, you just don't click on the medallion.
Okay, now obviously I can do all of the above without clicking on any medallions and get exactly the same content. It's all there for free. Why do I, as a user, join Kachingle and send them $5 or more per month?
There's several reasons we feel that content consumers will want to do this. One, they really do want this great content to continue to survive. The other thing is that they're getting recognition when they support that blog. Not only on the blog where it says, hey, here's all the Kachinglers, but they're also broadcasting it to their friends on Facebook. What we're enabling these content sites to do is to reach right out into their client base and have them do their marketing for them. And people want to do this because it's all about me and who I am and the things that I believe are important.
One advantage Kachinga would seem to have is that there is no paywall. Newspapers like the New York Times have found that when they tried to charge users for premium content, it sharply reduced traffic, and therefore the amount of money they could charge advertisers for advertising on the site. No such risk with Kachinga, you say, eh?
That's exactly right, because you don't need to have any kind of paywall, as you describe it, which is really the kiss of death in cutting off the viral capabilities of the web. I mean, you can't tweet an article anymore. You can't post it on your blog. The great thing about Kachinga is that you can still have advertising, too. It's not one or the other.
There's one other thing I have to ask you about. In exchange for the access to your infrastructure, you would be charging member websites 15% of all the revenue that you distribute to them. Now, when we're talking about the billions of dollars that go into media operating budgets over the course of a year, that's a staggering percentage. When you have approached publishers with that number, have they kicked you out of the office? Have they called the cops? What, you know?
Bob, tell me how you feel about this. Not at all. Remember, this is money that they cannot get in any other way. In fact, they think it's very fair.
Have you done any research to suggest what kind of percentage of users would donate money to media that they can access for free?
There have been some surveys done where, you know, the numbers look very good. But if you think about it, you don't need that many people to make contributions to make this viable, not only for Kachinga, but for the content producers. In the same way that with public radio, it's not everyone that contributes, but as long as a reasonable number of people do, it turns out to be real money.
Well, Cynthia, I wish you all the best of luck.
Thank you very much.
Cynthia Topaldos is founder and CEO of Kachinga.com.
There's been a lot of discussion on how to save newspapers, but substantially less on why. Of all the media out there, why is the newspaper deemed by so many, especially in the media, too important to die? We call on two journalists who have given this a lot of thought. Steve Kahl, formerly managing editor of The Washington Post, now head of the New America Foundation think tank, and Matthew Iglesias, political blogger and fellow at the Center for American Progress Action Fund. Welcome to the show, both of you.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you.
So, Steve, why do you think it's important that newspapers, particularly big legacy papers like the New York Times and the Washington Post, continue to survive?
I think there are four things that the big newsrooms have today that are likely to go away unless they're deliberately conserved. One is audiences of a global scale, 25 million or more in the case of the New York Times. Another is the independence that comes with scale, legal departments and deep pockets and an imperviousness to threat, particularly in these libel shopping globalized days. And the other thing they have is the ability to protect journalists from anything other than the perfection of their own work over a long period of time, and to give them the language training and the area studies that the best of them will employ to do work that matters and work that lasts. And I think those careers, which my generation was very fortunate to enjoy, those careers are going to be very difficult to replicate in the coming forms of journalism that I think we can already see around us.
So, Matt, what do you think of the premise that big newsrooms are crucial for the development of journalists and for the production of important news?
Well, I do think there's no question that a lot of value is generated out of the current model or the model that's been in the past and has been fading. At the same time, we also have to ask, not is there some value to the present model of the kind of big city newspaper monopoly, but is there any real way to preserve the institutional setting in which that took place? You know, you talk about, one talks about the kind of value of news gathering, of reporting that happens at these newspapers, but a newspaper is much more than just a venue for producing hard news stories. It's a physical bundle of paper that bundles together stories of all different kinds, weather reports, sports coverage, arts, book reviews, movie reviews. And there's a particular logic to assembling that kind of bundle, but it's an economic logic that has to do with the economics of printing and distributing pieces of paper. And it's not a logic that really makes sense in the present world. And I think we do need to look at what's most valuable, what's threatened, and find ways to bolster it. But we're probably not going to be able to succeed in doing that if we remain wedded to certain kinds of institutions that are products of a particular time and not very well suited to the economic and technological landscape that's emerging.
And you suggest that hard news, local news coverage, investigative stories are best supported in smaller nonprofit units like the ProPublica newsroom, which is supported entirely by philanthropy. Why do you think these things will succeed where newspapers have failed?
Well, this was specifically in the context of should we try to set up nonprofit newspapers. And what I was saying was that, you know, I think there's a compelling case that this is something that philanthropists are going to need to step in to do. The question is, do you want to try to channel that into this dying model that isn't really working anymore? Or is it more important to find ways to fund new kinds of institutions? And in particular, to identify exactly what it is that needs funding. Because some of the cutbacks that we're seeing in the newspaper industry are because there's genuine redundancy and overlap. It's just not true in the internet age that every major city needs its own film critic. But local news gathering, it seems to me, is really endangered. And so there needs to be a focus on trying to find people and institutions that can specialize in that.
Yeah, I think that's basically right. I don't think there's any magic about the bundle that does crossword puzzles and foreign correspondence simultaneously. I don't think that that's essential to preserve. But the New York Times today has a global audience in excess of 20 million, and it is extraordinarily influential. I'm just arguing to potential philanthropists that they might want to consider preserving the audience and the journalism to which it's connected. And in doing that, you can't just throw out everything that the audience likes. So it may be that the audience is at the New York Times because they love the redundant movie reviews that they find there. You would want to be disciplined by the need to attract an audience.
Well, you know, I think part of the issue, though, is that the audience is going away. I mean, there used to be a time when any large city would have several newspapers. Then a time came with, I think, the invention of television and radio that a lot of newspapers started collapsing, and we had the kind of one newspaper model. And that let a newspaper in a city, and particularly the newspaper in the biggest city, acquire a sort of authoritativeness. And it made the press very powerful vis-a-vis other kinds of actors in politics and in the business world, which in some ways was good because it's a check on other large powers. But the nature of the digital world and the nature of the internet is just that you can't maintain that kind of hegemonic audience position. And I'm not really sure what the point would be in trying to do it. And a risk, if we move to a more philanthropic model, to a more nonprofit-based model, of course, is that you're going to have less independence in viewpoint than you would in a commercial organization. People are going to be dependent in part on what their donors want to accomplish. And the only kind of cure for that I can see is going to be a diversity of points of view, a contrast to the old sort of single newspaper model.
Yeah, but I think that the problem now is the obverse, which is that we have the diversity. What Matt says is absolutely right. It's already happening. New forms, smaller groups, those devoted to journalism, those operating out of universities, those operating from advocacy groups and think tanks, all these things are already happening. Whether in the center of that, in addition, as part of the competitive mix, you would wish to preserve these legacy newsrooms, just as we make a national decision to preserve NPR in the mix of all of the broadcast media that we have in this country. What I'm searching for is a way, before it's too late, to consider preserving these legacy newsrooms.
I just wonder, do either of you think that investigative journalism, local journalism, foreign journalism will really pass from the world if the newspapers pass? Newspapers have functioned under conditions where they had a lot less money than the Washington Post and the New York Times do now for 100 years. They've always done good work and bad work.
They've done work of a different kind. There's never been a model of news gathering and career formation in journalism such as the one that grew up between 1960 and 2005. It's an accident of, you know, a lot of forces in the United States in particular. So, yes, some foreign correspondence and some local reporting and some investigative reporting, most of which will have to be the product of philanthropy, will continue. But I would at least like to give voice to the idea that there is something that will be lost that will not be replicated in these other models.
You know, where I agree with Steve unquestionably is that even if we keep having coverage from abroad, coverage of national politics, it's going to have a different kind of tone. It's going to be animated by a different set of values. And so to the extent that we appreciate the current tone and values, there will be a loss. I don't think that those values and that approach are necessarily all they're cracked up to be all the time, and that a sort of more passionate, more freewheeling approach has some real benefits, but it does have some costs.
Okay. Matt, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Matthew Iglesias is a blogger and fellow at the Center for American Progress Action Fund. Steve, thank you too.
My pleasure.
Steve Cole is president and CEO of the New America Foundation and a staff writer for The New Yorker.
Coming up, Great Britain bans the Dutch politician who made an anti-Muslim movie. Is this cultural sensitivity or censorship?
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, where arts and education leaders can learn about how to bring the arts to more people. Downloads at the Knowledge Center at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Earlier this month, right-wing Dutch politician Geert Wilders was denied entry to the United Kingdom, where he arrived to screen his 17-minute film, Fitna, before select members of the House of Lords. Turned away at Heathrow Airport, Wilders received a letter on behalf of British Home Secretary Jackie Smith. It stated that Wilders' presence in the UK would, quote, pose a genuine, present, and significantly serious threat to one of the fundamental interests of society. The Secretary of State is satisfied that your statements about Muslims and their beliefs, as expressed in the film and elsewhere, would threaten community harmony and therefore public safety in the UK.
The Home Secretary's decision was backed by Foreign Secretary David Miliband, who, paraphrasing a famous American Supreme Court opinion, said, quote, "There is no freedom to cry fire in a crowded theater, and there is no freedom to stir up religious and racial hatred according to the laws of the land." Of course, not everyone agreed. The Daily Telegraph called the decision an assault on, quote, "the citadel of free speech." And The Independent accused the British government of, quote, "playing into the hands of those whose agenda is to set fellow Britons at each other's throats."
If the film is indeed hate speech, it's more than that. There is a context that underlies this tug-of-war over press freedom, the so-called clash of cultures between some Muslims living in the West and their host nations. Nowhere has this clash played out more fiercely than in Europe, where free expression has caused offense so profound it has exploded into violence. Should all speech, including insults to religion and race, be protected? And when media and governments consider what should and shouldn't be said, what's the line between cultural sensitivity and censorship? The answers to those questions keep evolving, as Bob learned a year ago when he asked some of the people who stand at the center of that storm.
In March 2008, Wilders released his short film, Fitna, titled with the ambiguous Arabic word that can mean schism or provocation. Nothing ambiguous about the movie, though. It shows graphic images of horrific acts of terrorism, from the Twin Towers to corpse desecration to beheadings, juxtaposed with the Quranic verses that supposedly justified the violence. And for good measure, Wilders throws in video of various radical clerics inciting jihad against the West. The film was released on the video website LiveLeak.com. The next day, it was taken down after threats to LiveLeak personnel until security could be put in place to protect them. But how eerily the episode seemed to fulfill Wilder's bleak and alarming vision. A Muslim subculture that spawns barbaric reactions to free expression and a craven, ultimately self-defeating Western self-censorship. Yes, Wilders, the Islamophobic provocateur, has neatly identified the fitna in two cultures. There is the growing and largely unassimilated Dutch Muslim population, but also Europe at large, taught by history to flinch at the very thought of stereotyping. Mein Kampf, Holocaust denial, and other anti-Semitic propaganda are outlawed in much of Western Europe, where the backlash of colonialism and fascism has elevated respect for alien cultures to an article of faith. Dutch-born journalist Ian Baruma.
That was quite common amongst the sort of liberal left, was to denounce anybody who even saw a large number of Muslim immigrants coming into the country as a problem. Such people were very quickly denounced as racists, as people who were going to reintroduce the kind of racism that the Nazis had.
The problem, says Baruma, is that the impulse to stifle hateful speech also stifles healthy debate about social and political conflicts that desperately need to be discussed. And if the liberal orthodoxy is disinclined, who will dominate the conversation? Voices like Wilders, opportunists, xenophobes, and reactionaries just itching to confront the taboos of the left.
They are tapping into a common anxiety amongst people that the country no longer belongs to them, that they're being abandoned by the political elite. And this anxiety has been crystallized by a general fear of immigrants and Muslims in particular.
For example, in 2004, pugnacious filmmaker Theo van Gogh released a 10-minute drama called Submission, the story of four Muslim women. One is a pious young newlywed in an arranged marriage, beaten by her husband and raped by her uncle.
And when I told my mother, she said she would take it up with my father, but my father ordered her and me not to question his brother's honor. I experience pain each time my uncle comes to see me. I feel caged like an animal waiting for slaughter, and I'm filled with guilt and shame, and I feel abandoned.
The film created an uproar in Holland for its damning portrayal of Islam, but especially for the Quranic verses painted on the bare skin of the actress. This blasphemy was too much for a disaffected young Moroccan immigrant named Mohamed Bouyeri, who in November 2004 confronted Van Gogh on an Amsterdam street and shot him to death. He then used a dagger to pin an angry screed to Van Gogh's body. It called for a holy war against the West and specifically targeted the film's writer, former Dutch parliamentarian Ayaan Hirsi Ali. The Somali-born refugee-turned-MP is herself a harsh critic of Muslim law and culture, but in the murder of her colleague, she also casts blame on the folly of what she calls white guilt.
Mohamed Bouyeri, the man who killed Theo van Gogh, would not have done that and could not have done that if in the 1970s, the 1980s, when Dutch authorities saw the emergence of radical Islam within Europe, within their own country, they had taken the necessary measures, which they didn't.
She accuses the powers that be, in other words, of submission to radical intimidation and their own conflicted liberalism.
We can't try to silence dissident opinion. We have to argue and we have to engage with each other. And we can't do that by threatening to take people to court, by killing them, or by ostracizing those who disagree with us.
Such sentiment was entirely the point behind the publication in 2005 of the notorious Danish cartoons, which included hideous caricatures of the Prophet Muhammad, including one portraying him as a terrorist bomber. The 12 panels were commissioned by the newspaper Jyllands Posten after the author of a children's book on Islam was unable to find an illustrator, lest graven images of the Prophet be deemed blasphemous. The cartoons were intended to satirize Danish self-censorship, but to much of the Muslim world, they were a grave, graven insult. which is not necessarily a rejection of free expression. At some point, even protected speech is so disrespectful as to be beyond the pale. Think, for example, of the N-word. Mustafa Chendid is a Copenhagen imam who attempted to win apologies from the newspaper and from the Danish government for the offense.
Muhammad, for me, is better than myself, my family, than my parents, better than anything. So if you discuss his message, it's fine. You criticize him, it's fine. You insult him, it's not fine.
After weeks went by and no official apologies were forthcoming, Chendid's Islamic Society of Denmark sought help in Cairo, where the government found it politically useful to take up the grievance. From Egyptian state newspapers, word spread all around the world, leading to mass demonstrations, riots, torched embassies, scores of deaths. This demonstration was not in Cairo or Islamabad or Jakarta, but in London's Hyde Park. Kill, kill Denmark, Bin Laden's coming back. Westerners found it absurd and medieval that mere words and pictures would be deemed justification for violence. They wondered why millions of Muslims could be so furious about a disrespectful cartoon, yet fail to rally an outrage at the slaughter of innocents by terrorists acting in Islam's name. And they worried, at last allowed, if liberal notions of tolerance had allowed respect for alien values to undermine their own. Provocation. Schism. In Copenhagen, the mecca of multiculturalism, fitna.
The multiculturalist model has failed in Europe, and it's becoming pretty clear now. We have to come up with something else.
Flemming Rose, culture editor for Denmark's Jyllands-Posten, and the man who commissioned the Danish cartoons.
There is a misunderstanding of what tolerance means. The fact of the matter that today the concept of tolerance are being used in order to stifle free speech.
But of course, not entirely. While media and political elites may not feel free to share their most uncharitable thoughts, obviously some voices are stifled not at all. Not Geert Wilders and not radical Islamists who freely float bizarre conspiracy theories, spew hatred, and incite violence online. In the 21st century, for the first time in human history, there is an unfettered and instantaneous free market for paranoia on the web.
Media has played a big role in this democratization of fatwas, if you will.
Lawrence Pintak is director of the Kamal Adham Center for Journalism Training and Research at the American University in Cairo.
Everybody and his brother has a TV station or a website, and everybody and his brother are issuing fatwas. And I may have no credentials Islamically, but if I've set myself up as a cleric, and if I can convince a small group of people around me to follow me, and then set up a website and influence others, I have a big impact, which is something that Islam as a whole is struggling to figure out how to deal with.
Struggling indeed. Consider Ibrahim al-Hudaybi of iqwanweb.com, the English language website of the Muslim Brotherhood. He has been a moderate voice preaching calm in the wake of Geert Wilders' film Fitna. He is quick to denounce violence under any circumstances, though he's prepared to acknowledge he understands it.
If you're asking for why, it is most probably because most of the Muslim world is living under repressive regimes who do not allow for the freedom of expression, so we are not familiar with the idea of discussing things and disagreeing and being able to present our ideas in a civilized manner.
Hudaybi, like Danish Imam Chendid, takes pains to distinguish between free speech and insults, which he says are inexcusable. This prompts me to inquire about a double standard. What of the insults routinely hurled by Muslim clerics, politicians, and mobs towards Christians and Jews? What does he think, for instance, of Palestinian schoolchildren being taught that Jews are apes and pigs? Hudaybi's response is to differentiate between insult and expression of legitimate grievances.
Let me start by asserting that I am against any form of insults. But not every criticism against what's going on in Palestine and Palestinian territories or what's going on in Iraq is an insult to Americans. If you kill somebody and he responds by criticizing what you do, criticizing illegal occupation, of those who are occupied, and not of Americans in general, of those who are killing civilian women and children and old men in Palestine and Palestinian territories, and not of every Jew, that's a different story.
And there it is, a sense of righteousness born of a sense of victimization that purports to explain, if not exactly excuse, the radical minority of Muslims. So it's not merely different cultures and different values that separate some immigrants from their native European neighbors. It is also the fixation on obtaining justice from a Western world that conspires to diminish them or worse. To Ayaan Hirsi Ali, who was forced by death threats to flee Holland and live in hiding, that difference spells trouble.
These critical questions of Islam will forever be asked as long as the Quran is used as a justification for killing people, and as long as the so-called mainstream people remain silent and refuse to distance themselves from that violence.
A conflict forever? Modernism versus primitivism? Cultural relativism versus self-preservation? Is it really so simple and so hopeless? What if, for instance, the horror stories and headlines were obscuring a slow but steady process of assimilation? Author Ian Baruma's Murder in Amsterdam attempts to unravel the complexities behind Theo van Gogh's assassination. He says the doomsayers are missing something.
They assume that the third generation will be exactly the same as the first generation, which is, of course, never true. As people move into the middle class, they often become much less religious. They change. They assimilate.
The population of the Muslim world is enormous, something like 1.2 billion Muslims.
Professor Munir Farid is Secretary General of the Islamic Society of North America.
And many of them, especially those who live in impoverished parts of the world, look forward to gaining access. They want some of that which is Western. They're not too enthused by the culture, I admit, but they want the material trappings that Europe offers. They want the education that Europe offers. And guess what? They want the freedom that Europe offers. And in time, they get acculturated.
It's certainly true that ghettoized, marginalized, first-generation immigrants tend naturally to turn inward. Think of Chinatown and Little Italy and the Yiddish-speaking enclaves of Manhattan's Lower East Side. They had their own customs, their native languages, their own newspapers, and high birth rates. But they did not hijack America. Contrary to some alarmist predictions of cultural takeover, Farid says, Muslims do not represent a demographic Trojan horse bent on overpowering Western societies. Rather, he says, they're just fish out of water.
It's a very difficult thing to reconfigure your culture and your faith in a new environment. It takes a long while. This is a learning curve, and Muslims are indeed learning how to deal maturely with issues that are offensive to them.
And perhaps the learning curve is especially steep because of the societies they are coming from. Repressive ones, certainly throughout the Arab world, tribal ones, ancient and patriarchal, impoverished ones, rife with illiteracy and despair. Yet even Ayaan Hirsi Ali, after all she has been through, is at least guardedly optimistic.
Because enough people are waking up to the danger. There are lots of people who want to listen. There are lots of people who want to think about how to bring about that assimilation.
It's worth noting that her film, Submission, spawned the director's murder, but 4 years later, 3 weeks after the release of Fitna, no such violence has erupted. In Holland, so far, Geert Wilders' provocateur has provoked only discussion. And what about Denmark, where Flemming Rose of Jyllands-Posten still struggles in his own personal fitna about whether he did the right thing?
If I say, well, I will do it again tomorrow, a lot of people will find me cold-hearted and pretty cynical. But if I say, well, I will not do it again, then I will send a very unfortunate message to those who have intimidated, threatened, and committed violence during the Khartoum crisis and tell them, if you threaten enough, if you are intimidating enough, we will do exactly as you please.
A dilemma, yes, but one apparently resolved. In February, his was one of 17 Danish newspapers to reprint the cartoons on the same day, knowing full well how offensive the images are to so many.
This time around, there were no news value in reprinting that cartoon. and that it more had to do with solidarity with this cartoonist who had to go into hiding because, in fact, three people were plotting to kill him. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that in Denmark, over the last 2 years, it has become non-controversial to publish that cartoon. In fact, we have published that cartoon maybe 10 or 20 times without any reaction whatsoever.
No riots, no murders, no fatwas, no embassies of flame. Instead, shaking heads, a few shrugs, and resignation. Which, by the way, is not the same thing as submission. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Michael Bernstein, and PJ Vogt, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.